they sort of observing the person, see how they relate to you as a psychiatrist, as a therapist, you know, whether they're avoiding eye contact, whether they seem to be, you know, cold and aloof, if they seem to be engaged or not. And then you get into, you know, how they're speaking, how their dress is, how they're speaking, their appearances, in terms of picking up signs of perhaps other kinds of psychiatric problems that would go along with, let's say, mania or schizophrenia that could be contributing to their acts of violence. And then you, you know, would ask them questions about their mood and about how they've been feeling and like, you know, get a probe about depression, anxiety, irritability, things like that. And then I would think the key would be talking about the thought content, you know, talking to them about their understanding, about what just transpired, what happened with them, what their insights, what's their feelings about what they had just done, and making some sense about whether they're rational or not, whether this was because of some psychotic episode, or this is like most people who commit mass killings. This is a result of somebody who premeditatively set out to do this, and it was very rational in their decision to do such a brutal and sort of evil act.
So having the capacity even to think something out and plan it suggests some kind of sanity, some level of sanity. Are there differences between those who plan it out and those who just do it impulsively? Like, what's the quality of impulsivity and its relevance to a mass shooter or a person who engages in mass violence?
Well, again, a lot of anger and a lot of murder is, in fact, related to an impulsive act, meaning that much of the murders that occur, even involving more than one person, you know, which again would be by definition, some of the mass murders would be two or three people involved, but it can often be, you know, sort of reactive, something emotional happens, somebody gets fired and then they take vengeance that day, or somebody finds out about an affair or something and they kill a spouse and they act impulsively and emotionally, somebody gets into a fight and feels disrespected in the moment, and overwhelming homicidal feelings come over them. So most acts of violence are, in fact, impulsive in some way. What we know about these mass shooters is that they actually care, you know, we can tell from computers and their, you know, their history of talking to others that they've planned this for some time. It's premeditated and it's a result of a rational mind somehow in their mind justifying doing this act as a way to, you know, vent their anger or get some kind of justice or revenge on a school or an organization they think has wronged them.
Okay, interesting stuff. Impulsivity is definitely a quality. What other qualities would be involved? What about paranoia? I mean, first of all, what if they don't want to answer your questions? Like, what do we do? What do you do with a kid who's in prison and he won't answer your questions?
Well, again, you know, sort of not just not answering your questions, but also, you know, feeling like the person could be, you know, sort of very smart or street smart or just saying what you want to hear in order to get out of trouble and the like. So, again, you have to be, as a psychiatrist, you have to be very wary of certain things that could go on with somebody who's capable of murder in general. And that would be, you know, also coming across somebody who has some psychopathic or sociopathic traits, which can sometimes be, again, very charming, very engaging, and either feigning or pretending that they're psychotic or trying to get some kind of defense, like they didn't, you know, plan this, that voices told them to do it to get out of trouble legally, or they could sort of feign some kind of remorse or sometimes kind of guilt, which may not be true at all, that they're just trying to, you know, sort of just communicate to the interviewer what they think the interviewer wants to hear. And again, sociopaths and psychopaths are often very good at having a certain degree of empathy about what other people are feeling. Not that they have real concern and compassion about what other people are feeling, but using this ability to be empathic to other people's emotions to manipulate them. And so a good psychiatrist is not only sort of picking up about whether people are trying to make up things and be, you know, pretend to be psychotic to get out of trouble, or ways that a sociopath that could be using the interview as a way to ingratiate themselves with the interviewer to get in less trouble or to get out of prison and the like.
Mm-hmm. So it's a manipulation all around. I mean, it seems that the quality of feeling, talk about how feeling or the lack of feeling seems to be a common denominator. Obviously, a psychopath has empathy, is capable of empathy, of reading, not necessarily feeling, but reading somebody else's emotions, but not necessarily feeling it or having compassion. But is that a common denominator, like the inability to really feel? Have these people gone years without feeling anything? And what would be the conditions for that? Why would they be living that way?
Well, again, a lot of neurological studies would show that people with violent behavior, people who commit violent crimes, often have, when they do brain studies, areas in the brain that don't seem to be lit up or that are activated when they're shown either things of violence or things of sadness or like. So when they do brain studies of criminals, psychopaths, people who've committed violence, there's often evidence of the fact that they're not having the normal compassionate response of the emotional level, the emotional areas of their brain that are being registered when they're showing videos or hearing stories, where other people, more normal people, would have a response in their brain in terms of being both empathic and compassionate to what the images they're seeing or what they're experiencing. The sociopath, unlike, let's say, somebody with autism or Asperger's, is capable of cognitively, mentally knowing what other people's emotions are, but there seems to be, as we see in the neurological studies, a lack of feeling really what other people feel. They don't feel that degree of compassion or concern, and as you can imagine, to commit this kind of crime where you'll know that there will be so much sadness and pain and all the family members and the loss of life and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people affected by it, a normal person would find this intolerable guilt and intolerable pain to think that they would cause so much sadness and pain in other people. These people don't seem to have that capacity for that compassion to the pain it's causing so many people with their acts.
So a functional MRI would show this up pretty quickly. I mean, to me, that sounds like the next step in psychiatry or neuroscience is to take criminals and require them to have an MRI so that we see for sure, clearly, what parts of the brain are not being accessed or not functioning. And so we could tailor kind of interventions and treatments based upon what an MRI is showing. I mean, a lot of it is just guesswork. We're guessing that, let's say, the amygdala isn't working properly or where the prefrontal cortex is not functioning properly. It's still a lot of guesswork. What do you think about requiring mass killers to have a functional MRI repeatedly, you know, every 3 months or so as a treatment option and as a research option?
Yeah, I think that again, a lot of people are very interested in trying to both find out what biologically is different with people who commit these crimes, you know. So there's a lot of research out there that's talking about the biology, the neurology of aggression and violence. And it does seem that there are people who, again, they both have an impulse problem, meaning that all of us, we have these, you know, very primitive feelings of aggression or impulses that are that part of our brain, the reptilian deep part of our brain, that go on at all times, you know, that we have an impulse to do something, to butt in line, to say something mean to somebody or the like. And those the signals are kind of like the gas on a car. They sort of send a message like, okay, go ahead with this. That goes up to the higher parts of the brain, the higher parts of the frontal cortex and the cerebral cortex, where there's usually sort of a very quick kind of evaluation of this impulse. There's like a jury that thinks about it, and that's sent on to the frontal cortex, where there's a decision that's made to either act on this impulse or to not act on the impulse. It does seem to be that a lot of criminals have difficulties with impulse control. They seem to have an impulse to do something, and they don't have the kind of regulators in their brain that are able to temper their ability to not act impulsively. And obviously, a lot of people have issues with anger and aggression that aren't serial killers. And a lot of people who come to treatment are often dealing with these same issues, not at this horrible level of murder and the like, but it's still angry, primitive, angry impulses that they seem to have either an overwhelming anger that's hard to modify, or they have difficulty with that next step of being able to put a pause button, as Freud would say, where there's id, ego shall be, a pause button on an impulse to sit on a little bit and then make a choice not to tell my boss off or to say to my wife, you know, something horrible when I'm frustrated or annoyed 100 times a day in a marriage.
So an MRI would show a lot of these things. But, it still often goes back to environment anyway. I mean, you can pretty much guess somebody's neurochemistry based on their upbringing or their childhood or their formative years. I mean, we just learned recently that even the prefrontal cortex isn't fully formed until you're 25. So it's a good guess that this 17-year-old just did not have full brain development. And on top of what his environmental exposure was, you could pretty much guess at it. Of course, it's not legal to, curtail somebody's freedom because you have some variables that might fit the profile. But talk about some of the environmental factors that might lead somebody to have a malfunctioning brain or a brain that is just not processing chemicals properly.
Well, what we know in the childhoods of a lot of criminals and a lot of people with violent, aggressive behaviors, that there's lots of neglect and there's lots of abuse, both emotional, physical, and sexual in the childhood. And so this combination of an environment that's not sort of set up for a person to get the normal mirroring or the normal feedback loop with their parents and their family members, that they're of value, that they're cared about, that they're important, is very important to develop a healthy sense of self. Because what we see with a lot of criminals and a lot of these school shooters, it is thought that many of them have a very narcissistic kind of personality, meaning their personality is very fragile. They go through extreme ups and downs of self-esteem. So it's not just true that they have low self-esteem. That's part of it. But a lot of them have a compensatory sort of, you know, grandiose sense of who they are, an excessive need to be the center of attention, excessive need for praise and to be the best and the like. And it's very fragile, this sort of sense of self. It kind of oscillates between being too big and being too small. And those we know is because of a fault of growing up in a household where you're getting constant reassuring mirroring that you're worthwhile, that you're important, that you're loved, that you're cared for, both by words and by actions. When you don't have that as a child, then you have a much more fragile sense of self and a kind of narcissistic structure that can have this tendency to not have a good, healthy sense of confidence and humility. but one of either I'm better than, and I'm arrogant, and I make fun of, and I feel contemptuous of most other people. And then the other flip side of that, which we see with a lot of these school shooters, which is something happens that interrupts their sense of grandiosity, and they spiral down into feeling, you know, massively depressed and deflated when their grandiose sense of self is broken through. And it's thought that a lot of these people, something has happened bad in their life, and that they're scrounging to get some feeling of worth and self-worth and the like, because they're actually socially isolated, they've alienated people due to their arrogance or their narcissism and the like, and it's they're imploding in terms of seeing that they're not going to be this special, superior, great person that they thought they were going to be. And it is thought that some of them, you know, the idea of getting some notoriety, to get some fame by doing the shooting, is part of what's undermining the fact that they're doing something so public. Knowing that there's going to be television shows and news reports and worldwide press, it fuels their grandiosity. That's part of the motivation of why they do it.
So the narcissism sort of trumps any awareness of consequences. And the impulsivity takes over. Narcissism, as we know, is like just a way to combat an inner emptiness. It's a way to counteract not having any feelings at all, to really being empty. And so people will create these grandiose fantasies and a grandiose self, like I'm going to be a rock star one day, or I'm going to be a mass shooter one day. So they counteract this inner emptiness with grandiose fantasies, and when the grandiosity fails, or they do get some hints that this, they're just not going to actualize whatever these fantasies are, then this anger takes over. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and I think, again, getting to how this, hopefully this show is applicable to people in the audience, you know, there are lots of people, you know, a good percentage of the population that have narcissistic personality structure, and you see them in, hopefully it's not you, the listener, but you see it in your boss and your brother-in-law and coworkers and the like. You see how the narcissist is so often easily wounded, right? Because their expectations of constant affirmation, constant approval, constantly being the center of attention is often not met. And so they're constantly feeling angry and hurt because their expectations are that everyone around them should recognize them for their specialness, their greatness, and the like. So any lapse in that with people, any lapse of not saying that new haircut looks great, or gee, that was a great job, boss, or that was wonderful, or you know, you really look pretty, whatever, is met with a sort of injury, a narcissistic injury that gets them very angry and hurt. Let alone if you criticize them. If you say anything constructive criticism, anything kind of gentle and the like. These people, these narcissists, are very often free about their criticisms and judgments of others, but very thin-skinned and very easily hurt and angered, anger being a very important part of it, when they feel like people aren't treating them with the superior respect, admiration that they deserve all the time.
Makes you think of manhood and the struggle of manhood. I'm wondering how manhood or maleness figures into all this, because it does seem that these mass shootings are done by men or boys, and that aside from the neurochemical factors and issues going that are involved, that there's something about being a man and a male in our culture, or even internationally. I mean, mass shootings are not just happening here in America. That there's something about maleness that isn't being talked about or exposed. From a psychiatric point of view, what would you say is the influence of maleness in all of this?
Well, you know, it gets to the whole question of anger and the communication of anger and how maybe biologically and certainly in our environment and our culture, there are very different messages about how comfortable it is to discuss feeling angry and expressing your anger. So that certainly men are often shamed out of many of their emotions, their very complicated human emotions growing up, that would be true about feeling scared or hurt or upset about a situation, you know, shame that that's feminine, that that's not something that's manly to talk about, or, you know, why are you being such a wuss, why are you crying, why are you upset about something like that. So men are often shamed out of the rich, complicated emotional life that they have as children and young adolescents about expressing and getting in touch with their array of emotions. But anger is one of the emotions that's often, you know, very much okay for men to express, you know, so that's part of the difference. I also think it would not be honest of me to say that much research suggests that there's a lot of differences between the biological male brain and the female brain. As un-PC as that is to say, you know, because again, I'm like most people who grew up in the 60s and 70s, had some idea about, you know, genders and, you know, some futuristic view of all living in a, you know, silver pants shoot with the same haircuts and gender equality in that regard. But I think there's overwhelming biological evidence that men, particularly around adolescence, get this surge of testosterone that women don't get. And that surge of testosterone seems to have areas of aggression and sexuality that light up when you do neurological studies in adolescent boys in a way that it doesn't happen with girls. And so that there seems to be a lot of hormonal, particularly testosterone and how that affects brain development, that seems to fuel a certain aggressiveness in males at a teenage period that women don't have. Now, with that said, obviously, you know, aggression and violence are slightly different, and it would be naive to say to anyone out there that women obviously can't be bullying, they don't learn how to triangulate and backstab and be very competitive, but they do it in a very social networking kind of way, you know, but they can obviously be very bullying and very aggressive on social media and harass and bully in a very similar way. Men are more likely to also be aggressive and physically violent.
But isn't there, like, you know, we did in the men's series, one of the shows Armand talked about was separating, and that why is it that a 14-year-old or a 12-year-old male is all of a sudden hit by nature and evolution to have a blast of testosterone? What could be the reason? I mean, you're just getting going in life. And he talks about separation, that the whole purpose of this and by nature is that it separates you from your clan. You move into your own identity. You become your own person. Is what's happening to these shooters, these young shooters, the idea that they haven't really separated and in a way taking control of their testosterone, taking control of their hormones? Because, I mean, we could say that one of the functions of growing up is to regulate your chemical actions in your brain or in your body. It's to regulate and monitor them. And that if you're not able to do that, A, you might not be separating, and B, you might just be still immature.
Yeah, I mean, I think that from 2 years old on, 3 years old on, you know, having temper tantrums and the like as a child, are things that, again, the frontal cortex, the higher parts of the brain, a lot of our civilization, parenting, schooling is to sort of regulate and modify what could be very primitive animalistic reactions of aggression and frustration that, you know, that we experience as children, right? And so that growing up and being civilized is much how to deal with others, and then how to deal with others when our needs aren't met, when we're not the number one in the class. So I'm not the valedictorian. I'm not the homecoming king. I'm not the captain of the football team, all that kind of frustration, let alone the frustration that not everyone is doing what I want to do, that I'm not always the leader in the group, and that the teacher and parents and people around me are often, not under my control, right? So lots of, you know, studies would show that the average person has, you know, 14 to 15 episodes of anger a day. But anger would be the many 50 shades of anger, very nuanced shades of anger that we as therapists try to get men and women to talk about as ways to communicate their anger. And that would be things like impatience, frustration, annoyance, as subtle differences that is effective to communicate your anger, as opposed to just being, you know, one size fit all, just explosively rageful when you get anything that makes you annoyed, frustrated, hurt, or all the above.
At age 10, males and females have an equal probability of being murdered. By the age of 20, men become 6 times more likely to be murdered. 85% of all murders and homicides are committed by men. 91% of all same-sex homicides are by men, and 97% of all same-sex homicides in which the victim and the killer aren't related to each other is men. Do women have a problem with anger at all?
Sure. I mean, they're human, and they have have anger in them. Again, it's very important to talk about how anger is something that many people deal with a tremendous, on the other side of the spectrum, embarrassment, shame, that they shouldn't be angry, right? That anger is one of the 7 deadly sins, is anger, right? So that people get sometimes a message from their spiritual leaders or their parents that it's bad to be angry, right? As opposed to, we therapists would say, no, anger is human, right? Everybody's anger. All God's children get angry. And the question is not to feel bad and guilty about it, so that you're able to use your anger as an energy to get your needs met. So I think that, again, the anger that women sometimes struggle with is, in fact, their difficulty in experiencing, realizing that they are angry, and to communicate that effectively, as opposed to feeling depressed or feeling, what did I do wrong, and get depressed, when a healthier response would be to be angry and assertive.
Thanks, Kent. We're going to take a short musical break, and we'll come back more with Dr. Kent Robertshaw.
Thank you. Sounds of Miles Davis here on 99.5 FM WBAI. You're tuned into The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue and our guest today, Dr. Kent Robertshaw. And Kent, thanks again for being with us. I like to say you have to go miles and miles around to find someone like you.
Thank you for that miles analogy. I love it. Gotta love miles. Thanks. Always nice to be here.
So, Kent, let's recap. We don't want to give men a bad rap here. I mean, it's just the fact. It's just the statistics. And yes, men have testosterone, and testosterone does show up on functional MRIs and shows how male brains are different than female brains. Interesting enough that you can even, on an MRI, see an increase in testosterone. For instance, there was an experiment where men were given a mouse trap to hold and to fix and to set up, and a rise in their testosterone level, and a gun, and given a gun to handle and set up and load and checking the testosterone levels, and that even in the simple thing of handling something, a gun that could have, you know, a lot of power behind it, can raise testosterone levels to a dangerous point. And here's the effect of that. They found that when the participants dismantled either a gun or a mouse trap, they handled its components and then wrote instructions for how to assemble the objects. Then they were given the opportunity to put hot sauce into water that was going to be consumed by another person. The participants who handled the gun put in significantly more hot sauce and were also more likely to express disappointment after learning that no one was going to actually drink the concoction. So talk about how testosterone levels can be influenced by even simple things in the environment, and maybe what we can do or what people can do to sort of regulate that.
Well, again, testosterone, you know, is a very, you know, in many ways, very important part of human beings and other species, right? To have healthy aggression, healthy sex drive. Again, it's all put there by God or Darwin to have the species propagate so that, you know, having testosterone and a fair amount of testosterone is, you know, again, very important for males and masculinity and the like. It's obviously true that, you know, some behaviors are known to make men more aggressive, and that that can sometimes be related to their testosterone levels. And we know that, you know, that when people are, you know, sort of succeeding and at the top of a group, that sometimes their testosterone levels will rise, right? If you're captain of the football team and the like, then you get a higher level of testosterone, and sometimes that's good with a feeling of self-assurance and confidence and the like, which is a good thing. Similarly, if you're no longer the captain of the football team and put on a third string, studies would show that your testosterone levels will be affected. So it's a very complicated interaction that levels your brain chemistry, can affect your emotions, your mood and the like, but then environmental factors like whether you win or lose or succeed or not can then circle around and affect testosterone levels. So it's a very complicated interaction between nature and nurture, right? They feedback. It's a feedback loop that goes very complicated feedback loop in terms of how people's brains are and their environment. The brains affect how they interact with the environment, but then the environment affects the back to the brain.
Perfect. So let's recap again what a psychiatrist looks for, and can you give us an example of some of the questions on a mental status exam so the listening audience can really get a sense of what is going on with a psychiatrist and this mass shooter? What is the first thing that a psychiatrist will ask?
Well, I think specifically, you know, as it relates to somebody who's evaluated for a crime like this, would be some, you know, sort of explanation about what was their thinking behind it, what was their motivation behind it, and, you know, find out, you know, what went into their behavior that led to this sort of incident. And then ask questions, obviously, about the emotions and feelings as it relates to that, whether they have any remorse, whether they have any guilt about the behavior they just did, some level of insight and understanding about why this was something that was extraordinary or something that most people would consider as evil and criminal, and do they have any insight into that, and how do they weigh in on it? So specifically as it relates to this, you know, evaluation of this crime, those would be the kinds of questions that would ask. As a part of a full psychiatric evaluation, it would be a much broader sort of questions about relationships in their life, their childhood, their understanding of their relationships growing up and the like, how what their experience was of all those, and also their emotions as it relates to that. Again, very much sort of looking into, you know, people's understandings about what's going on in their social life, their love life, their interconnections with people. Because again, as we see a lot of these people come in who have a shooting, they're often very socially isolated. And as you mentioned before, Kevin, they often have a somewhat paranoid tinge of people didn't get them, that people were, malevolent towards them, they were out to get them and the like. And sometimes when we ask about how their perceptions are of other people, it gives us an insight into how people feel about themselves. Because again, what's true of a lot of people who have narcissistic, sociopathic kinds of tendencies, the way they see other people is a reflection of how they see themselves. So if they're somebody who's very unconcerned about other people's feelings and emotions, that feel like it's a dog-eat-dog world, and everyone's out for themselves, and everyone's out for their own needs, and everybody has a sort of a fake kind of concern and empathy and compassion for others that's really masking the fact that everyone deep down is very selfish and they want as much money and this and fame as they do. They see the world populated with other people like them, other people who are just, you know, Machiavellian, aggressive, competitive, just use people for their own needs, right? And so that's what you'll see somebody talking about their own experience. It'll be a projection, as it were, of their own feeling of the world. Their feeling of the world, that's often true of narcissists and sociopaths and criminals, which is our people are just objects to get gratification. People are people to be conned. Women are there to be, you know, slept with or to be used and the like, that nobody really has a real compassion or concern as other people with different rights. But the sociopath thinks the world is everyone's like them, so they don't see that they're that far off. Maybe that they're just smarter than other people and more successfully able to manipulate and get over on other people, or that they're just more self-aware, that everybody's very self-centered and self-interested. And issues like love, care, compassion, that's all a smokescreen. It's not real. It's Hollywood. It's fake. They know the true reality of people. But what they're really talking about is the true reality of their own psychology.
And they continually find evidence that shows their side of the story, right? They're never contradicting themselves. They'll never find, oh, there's a nuance here or there's a variable here. They'll always consistently reinforce the narrative that they have created. It sounds to me like it takes a lot of work to try and help somebody like that. How do you get them back to a normal narrative? Well, you know, how many years of therapy does it take? And also, is this latest mass shooter, Nicholas Cruz, getting any kind of mental health treatment? What kind of mental health treatment could a person expect inside a prison?
Well, you know, there's very much a feeling in the mental health field that there's little treatment available for psychopathology and sociopathy. And not just average narcissism, which lots of people have experience with people around them, but a kind of person whose narcissism is coupled with a kind of aggressiveness, a kind of callousness of other people, a sort of perhaps enjoyment in hurting other people and dominating people, a certain sadism, a certain, you know, pleasure in getting over and hurting people and getting misusing people, that, you know, it's not hopeless, but there, I think there's a feeling that these are very, very difficult people to treat. In my 30 years as a therapist, I've had a couple, and they're very difficult to treat in a therapeutic situation, right? And I've had some involvement with working with the prison population and the like, and I think there's a lot of containment there. But as a therapist, it's very frustrating at times because I'm reminded of the story of, again, briefly, the scorpion and the frog going across a river. And the frog had to carry the scorpion on its back across the river and made some deal. I'll give you a dollar when I get on the other side. And then halfway through, the scorpion stung the frog and they both started to drown. And the frog is like, why did you do that, right? You know, what was that all about? And the scorpion sort of like, that's my nature. That's my nature. And trust me, a lot of these people, their nature is to get over on everybody. Not just, again, during the business deals during the day, where, again, I think a lot of very successful people in New York City are very charming sociopaths, right? It's naive to think that everyone gets caught and everyone gets ousted, that people can be very slick, the art of the deal, very underhanded, all sorts of things in their transactions, and get away with it, criminally and otherwise. The truth is that in their interpersonal lives, their friendships, their love life, their children, their siblings, they can't help but to be number one and to get over on people. And most healthy people run for the hills when they deal with somebody who constantly is trying to get over on them, outsmart them, deceit them, exploit them, and the like. And that's the pain sometimes behind the sociopath's life, that they're not getting much in the way of love and caring and the like. They could achieve some degree of success, and they're getting some fame and some praise. They're getting praise, but they're most unlovable, and they can't help but, again, like Tony Soprano or something, just they got to get over on everybody. They got to cheat on their wives. They've got to lie to their children. They got to try to get money from their friends or something like that and not pay it back or something. They just can't have a relationship where they're not dominating and exploiting.
I would think a good question would be, how did you handle frustration in childhood? I mean, because it seems like the psychopath, the sociopath has created a narrative, a way to get around any kind of frustration. I'm going to succeed no matter what, and I'm going to use people as tools to get me to whatever, you know, conception of success I might have. Dealing with need frustration and want frustration in childhood, if you're bombarded with frustration and deprivation in childhood, it makes sense that you would create a narrative that I'm going to become a winner. I'm going to overcompensate. I'm going to never going to need again in my life. I'm always going to have what I want in life. That if it's a severe deprivation, it would make sense. But your normal child has to deal with frustration every day. And I would think that a question we could ask sociopaths, psychopaths is tell me about your needs as a young person and whether or not they were met.
Well, it's interesting because, again, not only are we knowing that people who have issues with – it's a very good question about anger and frustration and households. And, again, it's not only that people have more abuse and have neglect that would make people, again, more bitter and angry and have more of these angry, bitter impulses. That's – we have a lot of, you know, compassion and empathy about those kinds of childhoods. But one of the things that we find equally problematic is parents that are not good at setting limits and reality testing their children when they're having tantrums and are frustrated. And I believe that one of the school shootings, the Sandy Hook shooter, that again, the mother very much tolerated a sort of very angry, abusive relationship with the son. So again, a household where there's a kind of neglect that this kind of infantile, frustrated, angry behavior isn't met with limits, with consequences and the like, is part of the picture of a lot of people whose anger is out of control. Because again, it's two-pronged. It's not only why is the person so angry, and we have tremendous empathy and compassion with abuse, neglect, poverty, all the things that would make someone feel bitter, angry, envious of others. But many times we'll see a parent's that are, again, Johnny will get in problem at school, and the parents will be like, oh, the teacher didn't like it. Always kind of, quote, unquote, enabling the anger, sort of making excuses for the anger. And that kind of neglect on the parents' part is also contributing to somebody who you would think, as they're developing into adults and the like, their anger would be modified. But again, sometimes there's a sort of of a parental neglect of going along with the anger and tolerating the anger and putting up with abuse and disrespect from the child that a healthier parent wouldn't do, and a healthier parent wouldn't do to also communicate to the child that this kind of behavior is unacceptable. I'm sort of thinking of Cartman from South Park, who's so egregiously disrespectful to his mom, and his mom is all loving and poopsy and whatever like that. And I think that image from South Park of Cartman being this really out of control, aggressive, mean kid, and yet the mother seems to be tolerating and not necessarily encouraging, but not having the kind of limits and consequences that would help this person realize this behavior is not going to work unless you become a criminal.
Yeah, and so then a person like that who was not given limits as a child grows up to be a man who does not have limits and does not have boundaries. You know, and again, I'm referring back to the men series where show 8 talked about men having boundaries. Men not always saying yes, men saying no, and that this is a healthy thing to do. But if it is not modeled when you were young, if you haven't experienced somebody else's boundary when you were young, but you could violate people's boundaries, then you're going to grow up to be a person who, a man who's going to, you know, have very loose boundaries that can violate other people's boundaries, or your own boundaries can be violated. So I'm referring again to the men's series, and again, we got a lot of feedback from that, from the fun drive. And I just wanted to, before we go off, Kent, mention that again, that if you did want a copy of that, you could call 516-620-6302. Right, Ben? 516-620-6032. Okay. Anyway. But we're not taking calls today. We're having you back again tomorrow, Kent. Let's talk about, for the last thing for today, complex post-traumatic stress, because it seems that uniformly these shooters were exposed to some kind of post-traumatic stress, but not your typical seeing a car accident or being in a car, but being chronically exposed to post-traumatic stress. Can you say something about that?
Well, again, one of the things that's the consequence of post-traumatic stress disorder that is perhaps the most painful for the person to experience is that they become numb, that they become emotionally constricted. And as a way, as a child, to deal with overwhelming feelings of sadness and anger and hurt in a chaotic environment where the substance abuse and physical abuse and emotional abuse and or sexual abuse, one of the ways the child adapts to that is to start becoming emotionally numb, with perhaps anger, again, as the only emotion. But that emotional numbness that comes out of a post-traumatic stress disorder childhood leads, as many adolescents enter a period, they have a sort of dullness with their life, a certain feeling that other, not only that other people are feeling closer and there's more warmth in relationships, but that they're also able not to feel as excited about the Eagles winning the Super Bowl or are joyful about things as other people. So this kind of numbness in adolescence, studies would show, is results in a lot of adolescents becoming thrill seekers. You know, again, they have to overcome the sense of not just depression, but bland feelings about life as a teenager by doing reckless sorts of acts. Acts to get the adrenaline going. And again, that would be, you know, joining a gang, having fights, doing graffiti, doing things of a more, you know, sort of reckless, impulsive, thrill-seeking, you know, drive your car fast, all the above, do things like that, because life is making you feel sort of bland, and you sort of recognize that the pleasures that other people are getting, the enjoyment that other people are getting, you're not getting. The only way that you can feel anything and feel things deeply is to, you know, run into a mosh pit or drive a motorcycle 100 miles an hour or do something criminal. And that's often one of the dangerous things of having a numbing experience out of childhood, because you're then overcompensating, being reckless.
You've been listening to Dr. Kent Robichaud here on The Positive Mind. We look forward to you coming back tomorrow, Kent, and taking some very interesting calls tomorrow about this issue and what you might wonder would be a good question to ask a school shooter or somebody who's doing mass violence out in the public. We look forward to that tomorrow. Kent, thanks for coming by today. Ben, take us out. Thank you.
Thank you.